Today is September 25th, 2009. My name is Jessica Drysdale, and I am interviewing Felisa Wilson-Taylor at the Hattie Wilson Library for Kennesaw State University's History 4425 class. To begin, why don't you just tell me a little bit about your background?
I was born here in Cobb County, born at home, which was not unusual at the time. Went to Lemon Street Elementary, Lemon Street High School, graduated with honors, attended Albany State, taught Miami, and then came back home to work on my graduate degree. And in fact, when I came back, Kennesaw State at that time was a two-year junior college. They had just started it. And stayed here for a while, started a couple of black awareness groups, worked actually at the library as an assistant librarian and a storyteller for a while, and married a Marine, which I swore I'd never marry somebody in the service, but married a Marine, began to travel with him. And when he retired, we came back home. So that's pretty much, I've been in and out of Cobb all my life. No matter where else we go, this was home, because my parents were here. My brother's out in Texas, but we all grew up here, so I think of it as home.
Okay, how would you describe race relations in Cobb County when you were growing up here?
Well, and I'm going to refer back to an earlier conversation I think I had with your class. Race relations in Cobb County were a little bit different from a lot of other areas, because though there were identifiable black neighborhoods, there was not an identifiable black area, so to speak, because especially in the county and in parts of Marietta as well, the neighborhoods were integrated. The schools were segregated, which is really crazy. You play together all day, but then when it comes time to go to school on Monday morning, one goes one way, one goes the other. But the neighborhoods were integrated. Farmers lived next door to other farmers, and it didn't really matter whether they were black or white. The area up on the square were predominantly white businesses. In fact, they were all white businesses, but that area right off the square on Lawrence Street were all black businesses, and there was a good relationship with that. Now, were there odd spots and name calling and fights and stuff? Yes. But I think the major difference was we knew each other. And I know that sounds crazy, especially to someone as young as you are, but when you know somebody, when this is the man who took your wife to the doctor, or this is the man that gave you a ride into town, or this is the man that fed your family, when you all have that relationship, it's really hard. Now, because segregation was institutionalized and justified by the courts, there were certain things that were just, this is the way it is. But it didn't mean that everybody who followed those rules believed in them. I knew intrinsically, and because my mother made it a point to let me know, that there were certain things I wasn't supposed to be able to do or wasn't supposed to do because I was black. And by the same token, my mother would go to the Cobb Democratic Women's meeting, and I went to every meeting. And it was only when I got older that I realized most of the people in there were white. There was my mom, a lady named Miss Ursuline Adams, and Catherine Woods were the three women that I remember. And when I got older, I used to mess with my mom and tell her, the only reason they let y'all come is because all of y'all are light. Y'all blend in. But it was never, oh, you can't go. It was just, okay. So it was just one of those things where the institution of segregation, like the institution of slavery, was the law of the land. But it was not necessarily what was in every man's heart. There was always cooperation between certain people. And then there were certain people that never wanted to see a change. And in fact, if they had their way, we'd be in pre-1950 Cobb. Because this is what they still think, so.
Was that difficult to understand as a child, why the neighborhoods were integrated, but you had to go to a separate school, or you had different rules?
Well, it was hard, but see, your parents made you, and I will give credit to every black parent of that time, they made us to understand something that the law tried to change. The law tried to make us think that we were inferior, and that's why we had a separate school. Even though our parents were being taxed at the same rate, the money was not being spent at the same rate on the black school. But our parents and our teachers, and this is the one thing that I really had to work on, and in fact, this is the reason I started my Black Awareness Group here at the library, because these kids didn't get it, that they were descendants from kings and queens, that segregation was the white man's problem, not ours. He missed out, because I got teachers, I had books, and I've made the joke that I had books that were so old that they had people, especially, and I remember my history book, was so old that it listed people as president that had been dead for several years. But I had teachers like Lewis Scott, teachers like Preston Williams, teachers like Aaron Adams. I had teachers who took the time to go out and buy a paper or have the paper. I didn't know that the paper would deliver for free to schools. My teachers did. And we had to read the paper. That was our social studies. That was our, and then put it in context so that you understood that while this is being challenged in court, it is based on this law. And this is what has happened before this, so that they always kept things in context. So it was very relevant. But when I look at those teachers now, because I taught school for a while, and I understand how much work they had to put in. But our teachers cared about us individually. And the other thing is that our teachers attended the same churches we did, went to the same doctors, because there were very few black doctors, went to the same pharmacists that we did. So they saw your parents. And there was a fear that when a teacher walked up to your mom and said, or your dad, and said, I need to talk to you when you get a minute. Every child just cringed, because every parent let us know that education, nobody could take from you what was in your head. They may kill you, they may maim you, they may in some way harm you physically, mentally, financially. They could take all of your money. They could take your wife. They could take your dog. They could do whatever they wanted. Take your land. They couldn't take an education. They could deny a degree, but they couldn't take what was in your head. So once we got that, then all of the other stuff became secondary. Yeah, I would do things and say, well, I don't understand why, if you ought to just stop paying taxes. No, that's not the law. The law is that if you own a home, you pay taxes, or if you buy a car, you pay. Well, the law's not fair, then you need to change the law. But there was never a question that it was going to change. They just believed, and they wanted us to be prepared for the change. And the only way to do that was to be educated. And they made sure that we were educated. I knew about Phyllis Wheatley long before I got to college. And they didn't, and I used Phyllis Wheatley only because she was one of the, in fact, she is the first black woman to have her poetry published. But this was during a time of slavery when she wasn't even supposed to be allowed to read. It was against the law for her to learn to read, and yet she is writing poetry that the president is quoting. So, but I knew about it because I had English teachers that made sure that I didn't learn just about Shakespeare. I learned about Alexandre Dumas and the fact that, first of all, not only was he a Frenchman, but he was a black man. So she made sure that we knew. And that was so important. And what I realized is that these children don't get that. And it is no knock on white teachers. But not immediately, but sometime after integration, young white teachers, and this was based on what they had heard, what they had been told, because they had no experience, didn't expect as much from black students. Black students are like any other student. You don't expect much, you don't get much. It has been proven over and over, there are plenty of educational studies to prove that children, period, black, white, yellow, red, it doesn't matter, children rise to the teacher's expectations. Our teachers expected greatness and they got it. Now, were we all great? No. Were we all excellent? No. But we were the best that we could be because our teachers expected it. They didn't make excuses. I had a young man that graduated with me, and I'm not going to call his name, but this man, I believe, has somewhere an IQ of 74, 76, something like that. He's in the educably mentally retarded range. And as a teacher, I understand that. He can be trained to do simple tasks. He should be able to function somewhat alone, but would need guidance. He was in my class. He graduated when I graduated. We didn't have a special education class. And special education, and I tell my friends, special education covers the mentally disabled, the physically handicapped, as well as the gifted. All of that special education. So just because your child's a genius, she's still in special ed. And I have to tell my friends who say, oh, my child's a genius. Yeah, well, she's in special ed. I know, I used to teach. But the thing that I'm getting to is that our teachers would sit there and say, well, now, I know you're not going to get an A. You're not going to learn everything I'm teaching. But I expect for you to get a C. And they didn't give him points or let him take extra time. They worked with him after school, before school. They made time. And they told a parent, he needs to come in to see me 30 minutes before school every day. Parent knew. They got him in there. That same young man, and I'm not sure he ever married, but I know he has 4 children, all of whom went to college, one of whom is a doctor now. But had he been in school now, he would have been put in special ed, given busy work to do with no expectations. And so the really good part about that is that people expected everything from us. I told my daughter one time, when I walked out the door, I knew every day I walked out the door, I carried the weight of the Black community on my shoulders. Because whatever I did reflected on every Black in the community. First of all, it was a small community. It wasn't 15-20% of the population. We all knew each other, but because of the way the communities were set up, a lot of whites knew you too. So, in fact, I think one of the things we're going to talk about later with the whole city is, oh, you mishad this child. It was that kind of thing. So everybody expected great things from us. We succeeded in spite of segregation. In fact, I tell people sometimes I think we succeeded because of it, because our students primarily went to historically Black colleges, where long before Georgia had a no pass, no play rule, Black colleges did that. You didn't pass, you didn't play. You came to college to get a degree. If you happened to get drafted for the pros, that was a bonus because that was unusual. But what you did do was get your lesson. Now, we understood athletes were on the 5-year plan, but you still graduated.
Right.
And you know, it was just no excuse. Our high school students, I made my first money in college actually tutoring athletes. Coach came to me, Coach Rainey came to me and said, I understand you're pretty smart. And I said, well, I understand that too. He said, let me tell you what I need. He said, my ball players have to pass. If they don't pass, they can't play. And he paid me. And he actually said, if you find yourself liking one of them, let me know, and I'll give him to another tutor. It's okay for you to like him, but I can't pay for y'all to coat on my time.
Right.
And I thought that was funny, because I didn't see me liking any of them. They were dumb jocks as far as I was concerned. But when I did find myself liking one of them, I told him. He transferred to somebody else, gave me another student. But I made my money making sure that they, and it wasn't like I could sit there and do that homework. They had to understand it because he was checking back with their teachers to make sure that in class they were able to perform as well as they did in the homework. So I really had to teach. That's when I really think I began to find out, even though I had done Girl Scouts and Head Start and a whole bunch of other things that I had been teaching, I really understood that I'm good at explaining stuff so that people get it. And I'd rather spend 10 hours on explaining one concept and know that when you leave, you got that one. You may not have the other 9, but you got that one.
Right.
So I don't know if I totally answered your question, but I was trying to.
No, that's great. Do you think that your experience in a segregated school was common to the Black community, or do you think that it was unique to you and that your teachers really made the effort to?
No, it was common. Our class, we laughed about it the other day, because we do a thing every 2 years called the Cobb County Homecoming, where we invite everybody who's ever lived in Cobb County to come back. And we have a week's worth of activities and stuff, and it's fun. But I have, in our school and in our class, there are doctors, there are lawyers, there are PhD professors, there are college professors, there are authors, there are writers, there are musicians, all walks of life. But every one of them made sure that they aimed high. Now, did we all get to where we wanted to be? No, because my book is still not printed. This building is still not a museum that I'm working on. But I haven't stopped. I didn't just say, oh, well, I didn't get it this month, so let me just quit and go do something else. It was always understood. It took work. But it was not unique to me. Nor was it unique to Lemon Street High School. I think that if you talk to most people over 60 who attended all black high schools, most of them, a great majority of them, will say that that was the best thing about it. They look at their grandkids and their kids and realize that integrated schools weren't all they were cracked up to be because people didn't have expectations of them. I watched my brother, who had to finish his senior year at Marietta High, which was cute because he announced he wasn't going, and my mama announced she was going to quit her job and go with him every day because he was going to graduate. My brother's IQ is higher than mine, but you couldn't have told it by the first 6 weeks' grades. He went in and my mom was like, are you crazy? Hey, C is passing. She said, C was passing at Lemon Street. He said, Mom, they don't care. He said, I can be the only one raising my hand and they won't call on me. They will call on somebody else and give them the answer before they call him. He said, I ain't going through it. And my mother informed him that, yes, he was going to go through it. And if he had to start standing up in the room and blurting out the answer, she would come over there and deal with the disruption of class, but that he was going to prove he had a brain. And he was going to join the band, which was the other thing. So, my mother got off a band, which it wasn't awful, but it wasn't the band he was used to. It is the difference between, say, a college band and a high school band. We played like a college band because we had college professors who were our band directors who treated us like the only thing we had to do was music 24/7, that we were all music majors. This was their attitude toward the music, and if you didn't have that same attitude, you were gone. It wasn't that they didn't like you, you just had to have a certain attitude. So no, I don't think it was unique to me. Or even unique to Lemon Street. I think that every one of our teachers, in fact, when they closed Lemon Street, I found out something I didn't know. I found out that most of my teachers had PhDs, could have been teaching on a college level all along, chose not to, chose instead to teach black children, to make sure that they inspired us like somebody inspired them. And it worked. In fact, I told Mr. Scott when I graduated from college, I said, you did it to me. Because I had an offer of a scholarship to Harvard to go to grad school. I had a job offer with the Boston Globe, which I thought was cute. Because my only job at the Boston Globe was to report on the doings on campus of Harvard. So essentially, I was going to get a job that paid me to go to class and say what was going on. But instead, I went to Miami to inner city school teach because I realized that these children weren't getting what I got. So I became determined to do for them what somebody did for me. No excuses, do your best.
Right.
This was, and I came back home that Christmas and told Mr. Scott, I said, Mr. Scott, I was standing in front of my class going, good behavior and hard work. I said, I was you. He said, well, that's a good thing, Miss Wilson. No, it's not. But I understood. Especially after all of the sit-ins and all of the stuff that happened at Albany State, I perfectly understood it. And I was already looking at children who were, oh, you're black, you're loud, go to special ed. Had nothing to do with their ability to perform. The teachers didn't choose to change their method of teaching. They blamed it on the students rather than maybe I just don't know how to relate to this kid. I had a couple of kids when I was teaching high school that I just couldn't deal with them. But I also had a friend who taught the same thing right across the hall from me, who had two young boys, and every day they'd managed to turn her class into a race relations class. You don't like me because I'm black. My answer's wrong because I'm black. So we agreed. She took my two. I took her two. Then we went down and told Dr. Wax, our principal, what we were going to do. We were teaching pretty much the same things. Well, they came in the room, and I'm standing there with this huge red afro, short mini dress, or bell bottoms, and I was like, okay, this black thing ain't going to work in this room. But she didn't like us, okay. She didn't like you because you were black. I'll buy that for you. But why am I not going to like you? Let me tell you why. I'm not going to like you if you don't do your work.
Mm-hmm.
Took away that one argument. They begged her to take them back. She's meaner than you ever. Yeah, well, see, I'm not buying into it. And the two that I sent her, one did exceptionally well, and I knew he would. The other one, she had a problem with him too, but he still managed to pass, and that was the whole thing, so long as they passed. But it was, to answer your initial question, no, it was not unique. And a lot of black teachers that you see teaching are teaching because some teacher, and in some cases, it was not always a black teacher. Those of us over 60, yeah, but the younger one, it was one teacher that said, you're not living up to your potential.
Mm-hmm.
You know, an apple has the potential to be an apple pie, and apple juice, apple cider, garnish for a fruit tray, or it can rot on the vine if we don't utilize it. And we have teachers who step up, black and white, and that's why I say it's not a knock on white teachers, it is a knock on that time frame. Because in that time frame, those teachers didn't expect much. They were geared to believe that, yeah, that they're not gonna do well.
Right. So, now, what year was it that you were teaching in Miami?
Oh Lord, 69 through, I think 71.
And what grades were you teaching?
Oh, Lord. In Miami, I taught eighth grade, and then I taught high school. So 8th through 12th in Miami.
Okay. And so your brother was the first graduating integrated class from Marietta
mm-hmm.
High, correct?
Yes.
And what sort of impact did that have on your family? I felt sorry for him.
And I did. I really felt sorry for him because he had to go over there with them. And he was mad because he said, it's your fault, you should have gone. Because when they were trying to do an end around the Supreme Court decision, they decided that they were going to partially integrate so they could say, you know, the one black person in the middle of the picture kind of thing. We're integrated, leave us alone. And they approached my mother about me because they knew, first of all, eighth grade, I took the high school SATs and scored the highest score in Georgia. So they knew I could do the work. It wasn't a question of whether I could do the work. But I said, I ain't going. Mama said, you'll go if I tell you to go. And yeah, okay, I'm going to fight every day because the first one called me a nigga, I'm going to buzz him in the face. I knew I was going to fight. I was a tomboy. I was prepared to fight. In fact, I would have been angry if somebody hadn't called me nigga so I could fight. I mean, I was going in with a chip on my shoulder the size of a cinder block. We discussed this a lot, which was unusual because usually what my mother said was the end of it. She said it, you did it, and you know, it was like God speaking. But my dad, and I remember him coming in going, you know that child gonna fight over there every day. Well, she just gonna stop fighting and I'm going, he said, okay. She gonna fight, you gonna whip her every day. How much do you think she's gonna learn? Well, she's gonna go over there and she's gonna do this and they're trying to do right. And once they get one or two over there, you say, don't send her. He said, because she's gonna fight every day. I was like, yeah. I said, plus I can go to Spelman. I don't have to go to high school. I can skip this whole thing. I've got a scholarship already. I cannot go. You can't go without my permission. And that's not what the lady from Spelman said. So the first two that integrated Marietta High was Dexter Treville Grady and Daphne Dell. And I remember Daphne's middle name in a little bit. But those two young ladies went over there because they approached their parents. And Daphne is, I think you remember me talking about Lady Williams, the wax.
Right.
Well, Daphne was her niece.
Okay.
Daphne today is the sweetest, kindest soul. It's hard to be mad with Daphne for anything. She was the perfect temperament for that environment. Absolutely. Treville, on the other hand, was not quite as perfect, but they were friends. So they formed a bond. And when my brother went, it was a whole class. They had shut down the school, so he had no choice. If he was going to graduate, he had to go to Marietta High. Prior to them closing Lemon Street, however, the county did something that was smart. They said, you know what? This is the law, and we're not going to waste taxpayers' money trying to appeal this. Immediately, I think Sprayberry at that time was over on Allgood Road and 41. They took their kids first. Osborne, I think, was it Osborne or Campbell? One of the two down in Smyrna. Might have been Campbell, because I think Osborne came out of Campbell. But they just said, your students live in our neighborhood. Don't bus them past. Just drop them off here. Because see, all of the county school students came to Lemon Street. It was the only high school, period, in the county for black kids. All stay up, wherever they live, the schools just kind of sit, just drop outs off. We're not going to fight this anymore. So before Marietta High integrated, the various county schools of that period had already integrated, because they weren't going to waste taxpayer money. Because they knew eventually they were going to lose. So it was kind of like, you know, there's a better use. And like one guy told me later, he said, we got the benefit. We had well-trained band members. We had students who were used to studying. We had football players that could play. We knew, because you had state championship. He said, what were we losing? He said, plus the county gained money, whereas before they were paying Lemon Street to take the black students. That was money back in their coffers that they didn't have to spend anymore, because now their county students are attending. And in fact, Wanda had the choice. She could go to Marietta High or North Cobb. She lived up on James Street in Marietta. She technically lived in Marietta city limits, but she chose North Cobb.
What was her last name?
Name is Wanda, I want to say Wilkins. She's okay. Been married twice. It's Wanda Edwards or Wanda Wilkins, but
okay.
I've got her number for you.
Okay, go on.
In fact, her mother was the first female trustee at Zion. So, and she's supposed to be my cousin. My mother and her mother were first cousins, so.
Okay.
But she chose North Cobb, but she had that choice, because the schools, everybody was, you know, trying to figure out a way around this. This is the law. And like I said, there were only a few people who were angry. I think blacks were angrier than some whites, but we were angry about the underhanded way it was done. When they announced that the school was going to close in June of 66, right after graduation, they came down and tore this building down in the summer. Now, you've seen demolition. It takes months to demolish a whole building. This is a three-story building without buildings. Tore it down. And when I say tore it down to the foundation and then covered over the foundation between June and August, when school was supposed to drive back. Kids had no choice, especially Marietta City kids. They had to go. What the black community proposed, and my mother and Frank Sexton and some of the others were leaders in that, was that everybody that lived north and east of the square had to come to Lemon Street. Everybody that lived south and west of the square had to go to Marietta High. That would have fully integrated both schools.
Right.
Well, of course, there were a whole lot of white parents that did not want their kids to come to this fire trap that was Lemon Street. And the response was, it shouldn't be a fire trap. We pay taxes too. So if it needs to be brought up to the same minimums that Marietta High has, then you just have to spend more bond money. We're paying the bonds. We're paying the taxes. Instead, they underhandedly announced that the schools were going to be closed and that they were, you know, thinking there were several alternatives. One of them were the two schools. One was a blended school with a whole brand new high school. And there were lots of things they, quote, were talking about. What they did was destroy the building overnight, pretty much overnight. You drove down the street one day, it was there, and you came down a week later, and there were things missing. In fact, part of what I'm doing with the Marietta, this Black Heritage Museum, I know that we had a room full of trophies from the football and the band and the cheerleaders and all of the different clubs, the 4-H and the SLAGs, which was Student Library Assistance of Georgia. All of these groups had trophies that we had earned. For a while, those trophies were in the basement of the old Marietta High. I'm trying to find them. I think they should be on display. I think that my child needs to see that before some of the people that we're quoting now, that there were football players and basketball players and baseball players who went to the pros. Some of them straight out of high school. They didn't go to college. Millbrooks is an excellent example. Charles Millbrooks played pro baseball for years. He didn't go to college. He just had a fastball that burns your hand. And he's a great looking guy. Fortunately now he's dead, so he does not have to hear me say that he was a great looking guy, because I used to tell him he was ugly. But he was a great guy. It was a lot of fun. But he was a pro ball player. Coach Wilkins, which is what the B somebody, Coach Wilkins was our coach at Lemon Street. He went to Marietta High to, as he said, keep the lid on. His wife said, I'm not going. Because for one thing, they wanted all of the teachers that were department chairs and stuff. Suddenly you've got to be under first year teachers. You've been teaching 30 years and now you're under first year teacher. You were the department chair, but you'd rather have somebody who has only 5 years seniority that's your boss. And it does happen sometimes in the normal thing. Okay, maybe you went on and got your PhD and I stopped with my master's and you come in later and within 2 years you're my boss. I can see that because you have additional training. But when you have no more training, in fact you have less training and less experience, the only reason is to keep the status quo. And Coach Wilkins went over there and said that he would be an assistant coach. And Coach Friday, the guy that's the coach now at Marietta High, was in that class. He graduated with my brother. And there were times, I'm sure, those kids went to Coach Wilkins for everything. Because, and you have to understand, Coach Wilkins also had played, he was ex-Army, had played pro ball. Coach Wilkins was 6 feet something. Big, dark, big old broad shoulders, and a really deep voice. So when he spoke, everybody listened. It wasn't a matter of black or white, male or female. When he said something, you just all shut up and went, what you say, coach? Because he just had a commanding, very gentle man, but a commanding presence about himself. So when the kids were having problems with other kids or being picked on or not, being called on in class, I know I went over because I was at Albany State, and I went over a couple of times because my brother was complaining and my mom was in there. She was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. Your brother's going to end up quitting school and I'm not going to have a dropout in the house and he's going to have to do, I'm coming home at Christmas. So I went over and I talked to a couple of his teachers and I explained to one lady, and I don't even remember the woman's name, I said, I need to talk to you about Dwight Wilson. Well, I can't talk to you because you're not his mom. I said, ma'am, please talk to me. You really don't want my mother to come over here. Let me do this. Now, first of all, he's smarter than I am. He does his work, but he is getting disgusted in his class because you never call on him. You find little things. You'll find that his margin was an inch and a half and you told him an inch. And you take off of his, but somebody else has got it written on a postcard and it's okay. I said, you can't keep doing that. Well, he needs to follow the rules. Ma'am, I wouldn't mind that if everybody followed the rules. Problem is going to be, you keep picking on my little brother. I'm going to have to come and bring my friends. Now, you really don't want me to come and bring my friends. So, let's see if we can start this over. You're going to come in and you're going to treat him the same way you treat everybody. I don't want special treatment for him, but I want equal treatment. well, you don't understand and you're not here. Ma'am, you don't want me here every day. You really don't. And at that time, and even now with me talking to you, I have to keep remembering to keep my voice up, because it does, I know that it gets deep. And that's, it is naturally very deep. But because I was thin and I just started wearing an afro, so now you got this tall, skinny black woman looking like some kind of Watusi warrior standing over this woman saying, you really don't want me to bring my friends? Do you? Do you watch the news? Have you seen the papers? They're just burning down buildings. Do you want me to tell you how to make a Molotov cocktail? Ma'am, you don't want me to go, and you certainly don't want my mother over here every day. Then I went and talked to Coach Wilkins and told him what I told him. Felisa, now you can't be threatening people. Coach, I didn't threaten her. I just promised her that if she doesn't leave Dwight alone, he said, but you bother Dwight. I said, he's my little brother. I can bother him. He's over here to get an education. She's going to leave him alone. If I have to come back, I'm coming back with friends. Which I did have some friends that were just, you know, like, let's just go burn the whole building down. No, let's don't burn the whole building down, because the black kids still need an education. If they left Lemon Street up, and I promise you, if they left Lemon Street up, they probably would have burned it down, just because then they got somewhere else to go. But they had nowhere else to go if we burned this building down. I'm like, let's don't burn it down, but we are going to have to keep an eye out. So we did, but it was, again, teachers with low expectations, with preconceived notions. And again, it was because they didn't know these people. And I use it, sometimes I liken it to when I was living in Hawaii. I worked at an Asian bank. I had some preconceived notions about Asians, not all of them negative, but some. I worked in an Asian bank. There were 10 of us that were not Asian. Quickly knocked out some of my preconceptions. Some of them I'd sit there and go, that's why they say, and I'd mess with my friends by saying, this is why you got the stereotype, because. But it's, and I won't say I ever hated them, but I did have my ideas about, especially after Vietnam, because I had friends who died in Vietnam. So I had some ideas about how they work. Immersed myself in the culture there with them, found out that half the stuff I thought was wrong. Now the other half was based on some truth, but half of it. And like I said, it wasn't always negative. It just was, oh, what Asians do, or Jews do, or blacks do. People take one bit of truth and stretch it into a whole big stereotype, and it obscures that bit of truth. So
you're just saying, you think if each community had taken the time to really understand each other, things would have been...
Well, they were here because of the way we had grown up. They were better than a lot of places. But I think in some areas, Atlanta is a prime example. The black communities and the white communities in Atlanta, for the most part, except for the upper middle class and the very, very wealthy, operated totally separately. They operated in parallel, but not in unison. They were, as the Bible say, unevenly yoked, because anything you wanted was on Auburn Avenue at the Royal Peacock or some of the other clubs and stuff. Anything you wanted from Atlanta was downtown or in Buckhead. So, but Ivan Allen, Maynard Jackson's family, some of the other upper class families, the wealthier families, they operated on a whole different strata. Here, for the most part in Cobb County, there were some really well-to-do people, black and white. Most of us were middle class and poor. So that's a different intermingling, because we're all in this together. If everybody's making $10,000 a year or $5,000 a year, which incidentally, $5,000 a year is a lot of money. Lot of money. First job I took teaching, I made $5,700 because I was teaching in a high-risk school, and Dade County, Florida was actually paying more than the state of Georgia. So, but $5,700, and that was gross, that was not net. I had to pay all my expenses out of that. So putting that in perspective, somebody who was a doctor or a lawyer making $20,000 a year was considered wealthy, whether you were black or white. So, but here, because of the way we lived, and worked together, there was less, there was not a definitive line as for strata in class. So we didn't have as many problems as we could have had. We certainly didn't have the problems some of the other places didn't have, because we did have that overlap. Okay?
Why don't we back up a little bit, and can you talk a little bit about your mother and father and what they did for a living and how they influenced you?
Okay. Well, my mom, all my adult life, well, all of my school life, I remember my mother working as a librarian. But what you have to understand, most black people had two or three jobs. And they did it because, again, they were planning on your children going to college, and you know, there were things that you needed that nobody's giving you credit. Nobody, you're not doing banks and this kind of stuff. So you gotta, you know, work. My mother used to teach school well before me. My mother sold insurance for Guaranteed Life Insurance. My mother cleaned houses. In fact, she cleaned houses the same time she was a librarian for a while. And nobody thought that was strange. She went to college. She went to a historically black college. My father went to the Army, did 4 years. He was very, of course, segregated Army at the time. Got on at Georgia Power. Now, my dad worked before Georgia Power. He worked for the railroad that I know of. Then when he got on at Georgia Power, my dad drove cab, cut grass, did whatever needed to be done. My dad found a way to make money. And he did something that was unheard of at that time for black or white men. My dad would bring his check home and give it to my mom every day, every week that he got paid. But the cab money, the grass cutting money, any other hustle, that was his walk around money. But my mother got his check to pay the bills. When, much, much later, my father, there were young people coming who working at Georgia Power. My father had been labeled as a general labor for years and had trained others who became his supervisors. Well, the young people that were working for Georgia Power, and this is before Richard Holmes was hired as the first black in management there, when they said, well, we're going to sue Georgia Power because they're not paying us the same rate and they're not doing this, this, and that, and we believe we got to sue. So one of the guys said, well, why don't you ask Mr. Wilson? Because he's been here longer than anybody. And I said, well, you know, he's old, he's old-fashioned, they grew up in a different time, he'll probably say no. One of the kids said, no, I'm going to ask him anyway. He can't do nothing but say no. If he want to be Uncle Tom, he'll just be Uncle Tom. When they asked my dad, he said yes. He didn't come home and talk to my mom about it. He said yes. Well, that put them in shock. That threw them off. Like, that's what he's on. It's wrong. He said, but if I'm the only one that's saying it's wrong, they just think I'm mad because I was passed over. Well, they went to court. They won. Class action suit. They had to pay, and I remember laughing, because they had to pay my daddy back pay and plant supervisor pay starting from the first year that he had trained somebody to be his boss. They had to go back like 15 years with base pay increases. They had to pay all of this. Then they had to adjust his salary and make him a plant supervisor. Well, they had a plant supervisor down at Plant Atkinson, because that's where he was, right down South Cobb Drive. And he said, no, he said, kid's doing a good job. So he actually took a job up here in Cartersville for a while at Plant Bowen, until this kid left to go to some other state. And he retired as a plant supervisor there. But it was just, excuse me, funny, because we were like, Dad, they had to give you a grip. He said, yeah. He said, but it ain't no more money. He said, but now they're doing the right thing. And then the next thing we know, we've got Mr. Holmes, and we've got other blacks in position of management. So hopefully that won't ever happen again. And Georgia Power tried to say at first that no, they didn't, no, they didn't. And then when they started, and they were so stupid, which is also why I've got a new Facebook account, but I'm really hesitant about using it. because I understand what a paper trail is. I've watched people get tripped up too many times on paper trails. So they had memos detailing, well, yeah, I have Wilson train so-and-so. But if Wilson was able to train him, Wilson should have been one doing the job. But
what was his first name?
My dad's name is Emmanuel, but they all call him E.L. or Bro Wilson.
Okay. I guess let's go ahead and move forward. Can you tell me about your sit-in experience at McClellan's?
Okay. And I know I'm repeating myself because we went through this before, but the Cobb County Youth NAACP, we wanted to get involved. We were watching sit-ins and march-ins and wait-ins everywhere else, and we wanted to do something. And we used to meet down at Zion Baptist Church, and Reverend Cook was the advisor to the youth group. We decided that we wanted to go sit in at McClellan's, because most of the restaurants allowed you to come in and order food to take out. And I don't remember any restaurants, and that doesn't mean it didn't happen, but I don't remember any restaurants that had back doors. You came in the front door, you just had to get your stuff to go. You couldn't sit down and wait, that I remember. Well, we decided we're going to McClellan's. And we decided when. Problem was that I was younger than most of the other people who were going. So he told me I couldn't go. And I said, but I'm a member and I want to go. And it was a big to-do. And he said, no. Well, the day that they decided to go, he told me to go home. And of course I didn't. I started following them up Haynes Street, up to Lawrence Street, because I was going to go. And he got worried because, you know, you see this many kids going two by two up the sidewalk. Any white person with a half a brain can figure out they're about to start something. Don't know what, but something.
Okay.
As I was saying, Mr. Reverend Cook made me come walk with him. Well, when we get to McClellan's, we taken up every seat there was, and you know, we're all lined up and stuff, and we're sitting down. And there was pushing from behind, there was name calling, you know. Because immediately you know what this is. Blacks don't sit in McClellan's. And we're sitting at this long lunch counter, so already we have a problem. And the lady ignored us. And Reverend Cook, who owned the bar and grill himself, said, Miss, we'd like to place an order. And she said, I don't serve niggas. He said, well, I hadn't planned to order any. Could we see a menu? Which is really stupid. You know, it's McClellan's. It's not going to be gourmet. But he asked. And she said, no. She said, I don't serve niggas. So now she's getting loud. So there are people standing around and, nigga, you don't belong here. Why don't you take your ass back? And, you know, and it's just going on and on. And there was a lot of things said. Nobody really pushing up on us, but nobody's getting hit or whatever. Well, somebody had sense enough to call the chief of police. And at that time, I believe it was Bill Hudson, was chief of Marietta City Police. And he came over and he went straight to Reverend Cook. And he said, Pastor, what's going on? Pastor said, Reverend Cook said, we want to order, we want to eat. Made it very simple. He looked at the lady and he said, ma'am. She said, I don't serve niggas. Reverend Cook said, I told you, I didn't plan to order any. We just wanted to eat. And he said, well, why can't they eat? She said, grill's closed, because I'm not serving these niggas. He said, okay, if the grill is closed, close the grill. And he stood there till she cleaned the grease off the grill, emptied the grease pot, poured water through the things, unplugged the soda fountain, took the money out, counted it, and turned her cash register drawer over. He said, Pastor, seems the grill is closed today. So I'm going to ask you all to leave, otherwise now you're trespassing. Or come with me. So we all walked outside. Bill Hudson knew most of them, and they were all 17, 18 years old, so they could go home. He said, Pastor, I'm going to ask you to let them go home. He looked at me, aren't you Hattie's daughter? Yes, so, I mean, and I always had an attitude. I'll tell you a different thing, but anyway, I had an attitude. Yes, so, because everybody seemed to know my mom. But anyway, he said, you come with me. And Reverend Cook said, well, I'll go with you. He said, no. He said, I'm going to go call her mother. He said, because I know she's not old enough. He said, I can't just let her go home. He said, not even with you. Even though she came with you, I couldn't go home because he wasn't the legal guardian. Everybody else, he could say, well, I know that they'll be back. And they were young adults. Couldn't do it with me. I was a minor. So he gets me over, and the courthouse was then right down that corner. So it was kind of diagonal from McClellan's. And he says, where's Miss Hattie today? Is she down at the library or is she at home? I don't know. You the police, you find out. I'm just ugly attitude. So he tried, and what really bothered me was he knew my mother's home phone number. So he tried calling her and didn't get her. And he said, I'll check again later. He said, meantime, you go straight home. Yeah, whatever. You know, I just was ugly. And he watched me walk down Cherokee Street. Every time I was going to cut down the street, I was going to turn down Lawrence Street. Go home. So I get down where I think I'm going to cut down behind Lemon Street. Go home. I'm thinking, this white man need to leave me alone. So I get down to North Forest Avenue. Now, to Forest Avenue. He can't see over this hill. I know. So I'm about to cut down through here and come back down to the project. He's standing at the top of the hill. He's quietly walking behind me. Go home. Well, by that time, I was two blocks from the house. So, okay, I went down Montgomery Street. Once you're on Montgomery Street, you better go home because all the neighbors are going to say, Hattie, I saw the baby. Where was she coming from up in town in the middle of the day? So I had to go home then. I got home, and by the time my mom got home, I explained what had happened. And as I said, the irony of all of that was nobody got arrested. It wasn't a big deal. Atherton owned a drugstore on the corner. Atherton, when he heard about it, called Reverend Cook and said, they want to eat over here, they can. So when next time they went, which I didn't get to go with them then, but when they went, their waitress was the same way. She was not going to serve coloreds. She didn't say niggas. She thought she was being polite. She said coloreds. And Atherton, and I can't think, it wasn't Red, it might have been Red, but it was Atherton's pharmacy. He ended up being mayor. He came, put on an apron, took orders, and served. Well, a couple months later, I think it was maybe a year, less than a year, there was an explosion at Atherton's Drugs, and of course we all thought it was retaliation. Turns out there was a gas leak, but it was, you know, that was our immediate thought, that somebody blew it up because he fed us. So.
Now, were there other customers in McClellan's at the time? What mm-hmm. sort of reaction did you get?
You have to understand that training for a sit-in is like boot camp. You learn, you don't make eye contact. Because just like they tell you now with road rage, eye contact infuriates the person even more. So we had been trained that when you go and you sit in these places, you just become a statue. There's one person, in this case it was Reverend Cook, there's one person who speaks for everybody. You don't react if you're spit on, if you're hit, if you're pushed, if you get loud talk behind, you don't even flinch. You just stay focused on what you're supposed to be doing. So though I know that we got looks, and like I said, we got the bumps and pushes, I can't tell you a lot of their reaction because I was focused on looking at the back of that counter. That's where I was supposed to be focused till she stood in front of me and said, can I take your order? That I wasn't supposed to be looking to the side to see if they were pushing somebody else or pinching somebody. All I could focus on and all I was supposed to be focused on was that. So, because we learned, I mean, this is, you know, how you tuck your body protect your vital organs if you're being beat up and stuff. There's a lot of stuff. There's a whole boot camp involved in training for these sit-ins.
What motivated you personally to become involved with that particular instance, and what sort of expectations did you have?
Well, I was motivated because I still couldn't wrap my head around the concept of separate but equal. I couldn't wrap myself around the concept of whites in some way being superior to me. And I say to me personally, I mean, I just took it as a personal affront that some of the people I saw thought that because they were white, they were better than me. And I had, to me, and again, this goes back to being educated, to me, I had more brains in my little finger than they had in their entire body, and in some cases, in their entire family. But yet, because they were white, they thought they were better. So I knew in my heart, which is different from my head, but I knew in my heart that I could not live my life in a subservient position. I knew what my place was supposed to be based on what society said my place was supposed to be. But you have to understand that society gave me all kinds of strikes. Not only was I black, I was Southern, I was female, and I was smart. So that's four strikes. You only get three in baseball. So every day I wake up, I'm still smart, I'm still black, I'm still female, I'm still Southern. So every day I've got to fight this battle. And at some point, I'm going to stop fighting some of these battles. And this was my line in the sand. And I wanted to go because I got tired of being the one that's too little to do certain things. Every time they did other stuff, well, you're too young. I got tired of being too young. In my neighborhood, I was the only girl. So there were some things that the boys would do. You're a girl. I couldn't do. So it was, I was going to do it. I think if I had to walk up there by myself, I would have done it.
What year was this?
I was still in, oh God, I was still in, I think I was in junior high. I might have been in ninth grade. So that would have been 59, 60, because I graduated in 64. So it was early on.
Okay.
It was, you know, but it was just one of those where I was determined. And in fact, when I got to college, my temper made the rest of them go, okay, you can, you know, I helped with the training because I could be vicious with the training, but they still didn't want me to march because I would be the loose cannon. I'm the one that you spit on me. I'm going to punch you in your face or I'm going to spit on you back. But that was the whole point of nonviolence, was that you didn't react. I, on the other hand, wanted to react. So, and then once I graduated, my mother worried for a while because I joined a group that firmly believed that if we could not achieve full integration, that we would just simply destroy everything. And that drove her nuts. Well, these people are burning down buildings. Mama, they don't own the buildings. Well, it's the only place they can shop. Yeah, but they're shopping at higher rates than anywhere else. You go into the black neighborhood, bread is $1 a loaf, and you go over here to the grocery store in the white neighborhood, and it's 35 cents a loaf. So we're going to burn it down. You can't, Mama, I'm telling you. I've got the ballot, and I've got bullets and a Molotov cocktail. Now, either we're going to change stuff from the inside, or we're going to burn it down and let everybody start over on an even playing field. It doesn't really matter to me, which I think frightened my mother more than anything else that ever came out of my mouth, because she firmly believed, and she had reason to believe, because I didn't lie. If I told you I was going to get you, gonna get you. If I told you I was gonna burn something down, I meant to burn it down. Now, did I burn it down? No. But did I plan to burn it down? Probably. If I told you I was gonna burn it down, yeah, I was planning. I was scheming. Because I believed two things. That a person should be a person of their word, and that integrity and character count. So if I'm an educated person, I should be treated like an educated person, not a black educated person. Like that was some kind of special dispensation given to me because I was black. I didn't get to work as hard. I didn't have to work as hard for the degree that I have or that I got. And this was one of the things that I jumped on my kids about with the Black Awareness Group. You have to be better than to be thought half as good as. It is the same thing females have dealt with. It is the same thing gays have dealt with. Oh, you're a female, so how are you going to be a historian? How are you going to be an anthropologist? You know, you got to prove yourself over and over. And that was my line in the sand that day when he said, oh, you're too young. No, I'm going. I am going. Now, did I go on any of the others? No. But I went that day because I'm a member and I'm going to do what everybody else is. I just refused to go home.
Did you believe that nonviolent resistance was an effective method?
I believe that it was effective in certain situations. What I believe, like I just said, I believe that there are times that they, well, I'll use the old, there's a saying that old people have, sometimes before you can get the mule to move, and you have to get his attention, and sometimes to get his attention, you need a 2x4. I understood early on that money was the one thing that society put a high price on. People getting killed, black folks get killed, it's one more nigga dead. Black women being raped, it's one more woman, you know, teasing somebody, it was always her fault. But take your money, put it back in your pocket, and stop spending it, they start to pay attention. And then television, which has been the bane of some things here in this country, but television, when people are looking at a TV, watching people who are sitting here cross-legged, not doing a thing, having dogs turned on them, having water cannons turned on them, seeing pregnant women drugged and beaten, it touches the heart. You may think that the blacks were wrong for sitting in, but they're wrong for turning these water hoses on them. If you've ever watched Eyes on the Prize and you see the beatings that happen on the Selma, the Edmund Pettus Bridge, there's no justifying that. The staunchest segregationist cannot justify that kind of beating. The staunchest segregation cannot justify killing three voting rights workers and burying them, because they have families, they have children, they have wives. And at some point, your heart becomes touched. And that's, I tell them, thank God for God, because that's really what brought me to a better understanding. Because once you touch a person's heart, you can change it. Can't change their mind. Nobody can change your mind. I can't change your mind. You can't change mine. But you can say something or do something or show me something that will change my heart. I will then change my own mind. And that TV helped in that way so much, because you got two things going on just juxtaposedly. You've got the Vietnam War, which is beginning to ramp up, and you've got sit-ins. Sometimes if they didn't have on cameras, you couldn't tell the difference, because all of these bodies are being stacked up in Vietnam, and you see all of these people wounded and hurt in this country. I mean, Ali lost his title because he refused to go fight. Anybody else could take CO status and be fine, but because he was who he was and in the position that he was in, when he chose not to fight, oh, we're going to take his title, we're going to take his crown. They took it, but that didn't change the character of the man. So television helped a lot, you know, an awful lot. In my case, and like I said, it takes a changing of the heart. My mother wouldn't let me open her door when I was home for a while, because I'd open the door, and if you had been there, and you were like, hi, I'm Jennifer, and I'm here to see Miss Hattie, I mean, like, whatever, and I'd have closed the door, locked it, and made sure you heard me lock it, and holler back, Mama, some white girl out here. You had no name. I treated you the way I had been treated. I treated you as the non-entity. Mm-hmm. So, and Mom would be like, just don't open my door, because I'd get ugly. And I had to learn, and again, it goes to heart, not head. When I married this Marine, well, when I started working with my kids, I really made sure to emphasize to them, you cannot judge all white people, because not all of them turned on dogs, not all of them turned on water hoses, not all of them spit on you. Judge people by the way they treat you, but be aware of the history. And that's what I was trying to teach the kids at the same time. Be aware of the history of this race, how they treated Native Americans, how they treated us, how they treated other countries that we've been involved in. But you cannot judge everyone. You have to judge each one individually by how they treat you individually, but be aware of the race as a whole, which was a delicate balancing act. Well, I don't tell folks stuff that I don't believe. So as I begin to tell them, I had to formulate how I was changing and had to accept how I was changing. that, okay, I'm just not automatically going to hate white people because they're white. I've got to treat them based on how they treat me. But in what I did do, and I'll be honest about what I did, I met you and I was nice to you, but I was cautious with you because you're white. But as I got to know you, depending on how you acted, then we cool. And I introduce you to other folks or whatever. But I had to look at myself and how do I want to raise these kids? Because I don't want them to hate whites. Because the funny part is, blacks didn't hate whites. It was the other way around, which I think is what frightened a lot of people about, say, Barack Obama. Or even Maynard Jackson when he first became mayor in Atlanta. It was, Lord, we've been treating these people like dogs. In fact, we've been treating them worse than dogs all these years. Payback is going to be a bitch. I'm sure that's what they thought. And normal people would have. But the race as a whole didn't do that. Some individuals might have. In fact, I'm sure some individuals did. But as a whole, it was not a retaliatory process. So
would you mark, I guess, the time when you have had kids, started having children, as the time in your life when your personal views started changing then?
No, actually, my personal, because I only have one child.
Okay.
I call them my children. I have 60 kids that I have raised, but they weren't mine. But I've always tried to be honest. You can't be honest with somebody else if you're not honest with yourself. So I try to formulate my personal code of conduct. Didn't necessarily agree with anybody else's idea of what I should be doing. It was just what I thought I should be doing. So with the children, when I was trying to make sure, because like I said, they were not in integrated schools. They were not getting black history. They didn't understand the history of Cobb County. They didn't understand the history of Marietta. They were getting what I call orange juice light or history light. They were getting the watered down version. Like, oh yeah, there was slavery, and then there was Jim Crow. Well, actually, then it was segregation. Well, then that was Reconstruction. Then there was segregation, and now it's integration. Like, it all flowed so smoothly. And that's not the way it happened. It was like pulling out fingernails. This was a tumultuous time in this country over a long, extended period of time. So to make sure that these children understood and knew their history, I taught history. To make sure they understood their value in the community, I made them do community projects. You know, and education was key. I have the library, I think at that time, closed at 9 o'clock. I'd been out here 12:30, 1 o'clock, getting homework, which had to be done to my satisfaction before you left the building. I get mama's call, they got to go to school tomorrow. That's not my problem. They got to have this homework, and it's got to be done right. My daughter will tell you she had a teacher that I asked to have her removed from a room because it was supposed to be some kind of writing class, and I looked it up and I was like, but baby, it's one long run-on sentence. It's, you know, the punctuation, did you check spelling and stuff? My teacher doesn't care about that. So I call, ma'am, I'm Tangelita's mother, and I just looked over her paper. Oh, it's a wonderful paper. Ma'am, she has run-on sentences, she has commas inappropriately, she has misspelled words, she has no capitalization. It's like she did stream of thought writing and she just turned it in. She says, well, we don't want to stifle their creativity. Ma'am, I want my child to be able to get a job, and she cannot get a job like this. I took her out of a phonics class when she was in first grade because I wanted her to learn to read whole words, not phonetically, because people who learn to read phonetically can't spell. I taught too many of them. I taught adult ed. I've taught the secretary of training. They can't speak. And then I'm looking at tweet and Facebook and cell phones now and realize we're back to not being able to spell. But I wanted her to be able to get a job. And the teacher just didn't understand. Well, I think you're a little hard on us. I said, ma'am, tell you what we're going to do. We're going to make it easy. We'll just switch her class. And I had a moment. And I told her why. I said, this lady does not have your best interest at heart. She says that she's allowing you to be creative and free. You can't sell this to anybody because nobody can read it because they got to keep stop going back trying to figure out what this misspelled word is or why this comma is here. Now go back and write this story in a manner that is acceptable. So much so that even the rest of the time my child was in high school, she said, "Mama, look at this, but put your red pen down first," because I'd have a red pen in my head somewhere. There are kids right now with grandkids who will tell you when they come to the library to show me something, and go, "Can I mark on it? We knew you were going to." Because I can't let it go. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're black. You're three. When my child was small and had to send, that's no excuse. When she had to send thank you notes. We weren't stationed here, so if my mama sent you something, you sent a thank you note. And what I would do is say, "What do you want to tell Granny about the new lunchbox? I really like it because pink is my favorite color." I used to go and get those big writing tablets that you have for first graders, and I would print, "Dear Granny, I really like my lunchbox. It's pink. That's my favorite color." And I would print in large letters. Sometimes it would take 3 or 4 pages. And then we'd sit down together, and she would trace. That's all she was doing. She wasn't really writing, but she learned how to form these letters. And then we'd fold it up and have to put it in a brown envelope because it wouldn't fit in a regular envelope. And we'd mail the thank you note. She learned 2 things. One, that Granny don't owe you nothing. So she has a right to a thank you note for her thinking of you. 2, she learned to write. She learned to read. By the time she was 3, she was reading. She was writing. She'd write her own thank you note. She'd write little notes and go home with a question mark because she'd gotten bored. But she's asked me, "Can we go home?" I understood that. But using her own language to teach her to read. I don't accept excuses. And with these kids, it was, what do I tell them? Do I prepare them for the world that is or the world that is to be? So what I tried to do was not only prepare them for the world that should be, but what their place should be in it. And I know I did at least one right, because one little boy I ran into the other day, who's not a little boy anymore, he's a grown man, he started laughing. He said, "You remember you used to get on me about my lesson, and you'd stay on me, and sometimes you'd put me out of the library because I wasn't studying and stuff." I said, "Yeah, well, it looks like it turned out okay, because it looks like you got a job and stuff." He said, "Well, I'm fine." He said, "My son just graduated from Harvard this June." I was like, "What?" He said, "Well, I stayed on him the same way you stayed on us." He said, "I keep him up all night going, 'No, boy, go back in there, get that, let me see this homework. Don't tell me it's done, let me see it.' He said, 'I don't care what time I got home at night, but I'd sit there and do it." We went over, he said, sometimes he'd be up all night. He said, "But he just graduated." He said, "I did to him what you did to us, because you were absolutely right." And I was like, "Thank you. If I don't get but one, thank you, I got it." So
let me just go back really quick and ask, Bill Hudson, who you said was the chief of police at the time, was he generally supportive of the black community here? Or?
Bill Hudson was a fair man, and I don't, because I didn't know him. I mean, I knew him because of my mom, but the one thing I know about him, and again, somebody else's perception may be different, but Bill tried to be fair and apply the law fairly, which in that day and time was unusual in and of itself, because the rules seemed to bend, the scales of justice seemed to tilt toward whites. The old joke, African proverb, chicken does not stand a chance in court if both the judge and the jury are foxes. Well, that's kind of the way it was, but Bill wasn't like that. He seemed to try to be fair. Now, I'm sure he probably at points in time used the word colored, nigger. I'm sure he did, because it was what people said. But when it came to applying the law, that was not the way he applied it. Mm-hmm. And that's why, in fact, he used to do a country boil and stuff. He ended up going to the Cobb County Police Department for a while. And in fact, I think now he's director of Georgia's Department of Safety Training and stuff. But he'd do a country boil and stuff. I'd go. Sometimes I'd be the only black person out there. But it was like, no, I know the bill, I know. Mm-hmm. Tried to be fair, or see my appearance. Like I said, I can only speak for mine. Somebody else may tell you, "Oh no, he was the most prejudiced man in the world." That may be, but what I saw was a person trying to fairly apply the law, or equally apply the law to every situation, to everybody.
And real quick about McClellan's, is the storefront still there?
It is next door to, I think it's Eddie's Trick Shop.
Okay.
Because where Eddie's Trick Shop is, used to be Mr. Medford's bookstore.
Okay, so it's next door to
mm-hmm.
the church. Let's talk a little bit about your experience at Albany State. And I know the Albany movement was in 1961, and that was before your time there, but what sort of legacy did that leave?
Well, it was still going on. Albany was definitely didn't want to integrate and change. In fact, Albany, Daughtry County, convinced the state of Georgia to build a junior college rather than have their white kids go to Albany State College. So they actually had Albany Junior College, which I thought was funny. It happened while I was down there. There were definite, as opposed to Marietta, there were definite black areas in Albany. And there was a resentment. And I think the resentment, and it was really funny because looking back, I believe the greater resentment was not that we were black, it was that we were college educated. Because they had the same attitude toward the Marines, black or white. We had a job. That is an agricultural area there. So, you think you're better than me because you go to college, but you still colored. Well, yeah, but I've got a degree. You don't. So, I really, in looking back, think that was part of the problem. Because the college initially was put in a... with the land that was bought was in a situation, an area that flooded on a regular basis. But people made do, they made it work, and it grew. And in fact, now the college owns most of the land that was around it and stuff, and we've expanded tremendously. I was back a couple of years ago and couldn't believe how it has expanded. But the church that I used to attend, which you know how you tell yourself, once I get out of mama's house, she ain't gonna make me go to church. I went straight on up the street to this little black church, which is where all of the sit-ins started. This is where they did the training. Didn't know it when I went. It was just about a block from campus and a block from the bowling alley. Now, when we went to the bowling alley, this is, by then, this is 64. When I'm there, it was token segregation. Trust me, we walk in, we college students, or we're their military personnel, they got money. These people did not care. How can I help y'all? It was like, okay, I know technically we don't serve black people in, but they got money. And that was the way they looked at it. And that really began to solidify my bottom line that it's all about green. You know, the old joke, he who has the gold makes the rules. That's the bottom line. So Albany State was a learning experience in a lot of ways for me, because I ran into blacks who came from very diverse backgrounds. But we were all going to a historically black college, because then we know we are guaranteed a good education. We knew that. But I had a good friend, and to give you an idea of the diversity, I had a good friend whose parents from down in America. So I'm thinking, oh, poor thing, you know, this is real country. This is where fighting goes on and lynching and whatever. My daddy owns a dairy farm with 400 and something acres, and he's raising Black Angus cows and stuff. I understood that Black Angus was the top of the line cow. Then I find out she's got her own car. Well, this was absolutely unheard of when most adults didn't have a car. But their parents bought each of them a car upon graduation from high school. So, and then one of the guys that played basketball came from Cincinnati. He drove his own midget, little convertible, down. Now, my parents were, comparatively speaking, pretty well off, but wasn't nobody buying me no car. These kids were getting cars. But then I'd meet somebody else. I had a friend, in fact, a guy that taught me to shoot pool, who played pool twice a year to pay his and his sister's tuition. He was a pool shark. But somebody had told him, and he believed, that education was the way, not hustling in pool. Now, if he'd have been white instead of black, he'd have been a new Minnesota Fats, he'd have been playing on TV right now. because he only played twice a year, but he paid both of their tuition, all of their books, the two times he played. So he was very good. And understand, we're talking about gas still being, I think, 35, 45 cents a gallon. So, you know, tuition to $2,000 a year, to get $4,000 twice a year to take care of it. But he had told his sister if she got out of school, graduated with decent grades, that he'd make sure she went to college. Mm-hmm. And they saw him paying for his way, so they believed him. So once a year, he'd make enough money to pay both their tuition. Now, twice a year, he'd pay everybody's tuition. So, you know, it was such a wide cross-section. Because college and education is a great equalizer. And again, we go back to what you got in your brain, nobody's gonna take away from it. So I watched teachers. That was the first time that I had been exposed to any other than black teachers. So all of a sudden I've got Asian teachers and I've got Hispanic teachers and white teachers. And I'm looking like, why are they here? Because of course I was a very suspicious person. Realized that they had the same work ethics as my high school teachers had had. All they wanted was for me to get a good education, right, to be a functioning part of society. That's all they wanted. So it was a great experience for me.
So you attended from 64 to 68?
69.
Okay.
Yeah, I went on the five-year plan. Well, I kept quitting to go to marches in Alabama and Tennessee and anywhere else.
Oh, wow. Tell me about those.
I just would go. I mean, if they were having a march in Alabama and they wanted all of us to show up, we went. If Alabama State or the Alabama A&M were having problems on that campus, we'd all show up. Mm-hmm. You know, you're sitting there thinking, okay, the school actually only has 1,000 people. Why are there 5,000 kids out here? Well, that's because kids from Savannah State and Fort Valley State and Miles University in South Carolina, we were all there in support. Mm-hmm. So I kind of went. And then I kept deciding I really didn't want to teach. I didn't want to teach, even though I was very, very good at it. So one year, I just came home at Thanksgiving and didn't go back till January. Took no finals and passed all my classes. And it was so funny because one lady told me, she says, I can't give you a grade till you take the final. I said, okay, just give me an F. She said, I'm not giving you an F. She said, you're going to take the final. And I stood at her desk with a pen and a pencil and went through it. Took me about 20 minutes and I handed it back to her. I said, there you go, now you can give me the F. She checked it and she said, no, I'm not giving you the F. I'm giving you the A that you made. I wasn't in school for 6 weeks. But my grades up to that point. And the reason she wouldn't give me an F, even though I showed up to her class once a week because she had an exam on Friday. She had tests every Friday. I'd show up on Friday, take the test. I have stood on by her desk and taken the test and then walked off. But going to Albany was very different from me because it is so rural and it was so southern and it was things I was not used to. So.
Can you tell me a little bit about the Black Awareness Group that you've started and the Heritage Museum that you're working on?
Yeah, the Black Awareness Group was a group of teenagers that I found myself counseling. They'd come in and go, Miss Fifi so-and-so, especially stuff still going on at Marietta High and whatever. And go, okay, well, now you need to look at this way and put this in perspective. And I start talking to them, and finally, they wanted to do something. I said, I tell you what, let's do. Let's go ahead and form you all into a club. Elect officers, and I will act as advisor. But, you know, because there were times I'd be sitting there telling them about things in Black history and stuff that they weren't getting. I said, and we'll devote part of the time each day that you all come, each meeting time, to Black history, both local and national and international, and talking about whatever's on your mind. But you have to promise me that the rules that I'm going to lay down for you, you'll be able to follow. Like, yeah, we'll do it. So they sat down and they formed the group. And they called themselves, oh, God, at first they had all kinds of names. And when I talked to them, I said, what are you trying to do? Oh, you're going to teach us about Black history and we're going to do this and that. I said, okay, so let's call it the Black Awareness Group. Because that's what I want you to do. Be aware that you are Black. Be aware of your history. Be aware of your place in the community. Okay, cool, because then we can tell. And they actually have t-shirts made up, which I actually have my old t-shirt that says, get out of your bag, get in our bag. So And it was get out of the old habits, get into the habit of learning and supporting the Black community. I watched my kids organize a community block party. I watched them organize a community cleanup. And when I say organize, I would advise, but they had to do the work. Just like Dr. Scott's got you down here trying to talk to me. They had to do the work. They had to contact the city of Marietta to see if they could get a special pickup on Saturdays. You know, they had to arrange to go in these people's houses and say, look, we're going to have a dump truck come. If you got old furniture, old refrigerator, whatever it is that needs to come out, we will be by that Saturday to take it out for you. Set it on the curb. It'll be moved. It won't be an eyesore. They arranged with the city of Marietta to have the sweepers come. They went to every person that had a car and said, you need to move your car that day because we're going to clean the street. Then we're going to have a block party afterward. But they did it. I just sat back there and listened. But that's what they were supposed to do. That's what my parents did to me. That's what my teachers did to me. But they didn't have anybody doing it. Because one, their parents were working so hard to maintain this style of living. And it became more difficult. The other was that they didn't have anybody that cared enough to do it. I did. And I pushed and I put, and grades were important. They will tell you I showed up in their classrooms. I stayed down here at the library. I did whatever needed to be done to get them through school. I threatened kids. I had one kid I forced to walk from Marietta Middle School back over to old Marietta High School. He cut school that day to go see his little girlfriend who was in eighth grade. I saw him. I made him walk. He walked down South Marietta Parkway. Police pulled us over and said, ma'am, is there a problem? No. He cut school. He walked over. He ain't going to walk back. I said, ma'am, I can't let you have this kid walking in the street like this. That's okay. He can walk on the sidewalk. And we put him up on the sidewalk, and the cop left. And I immediately stopped my car and said, get you behind back down the street. And he was like, but the cop said, I said, yeah, but see, the cop don't know that what I know. You'll try to run if you're on the sidewalk, and then I got to stop, park my car, and chase you. If you're in the street, I'll just run over you. And I walked him. By the time we got back to the school was getting out for the day. We marched into Edna Lee's office. She was the principal at the time in Marietta High. And I said, this young man cut school today, but I don't think he'll cut tomorrow. And she said, Thomas, where have you been? In fact, it's Wanda's brother, the lady I was talking about. She said, where have you been? I said, he was over there at Marietta Middle School. She said, are you over there seeing? And she called the little girl's name. I said, that's where he was. I said, but he won't go tomorrow. He finished school on time. We didn't have a problem. He decided, you would have hit me with the car, CEO, and your mama's a nurse, so it'd have been okay. And so.
Now, is the group something that's still going on today?
No, but all of my kids, and the one thing I told them they had to do, because they used to tell, when we grow up, we're going to do this, and we're going to take care of you. No, what you're going to do is, when you see somebody else's kid that's not getting the attention, was not living up to their potential, not doing what they're supposed to do, you're going to reach back and pull that kid's kicking and screaming like I had to pull some of you and say, let me tell you what you're going to do. This is not an option. Failure is not an option. You will graduate. You will go to college. You will do this. You will stay out of jail. You will whatever. That's what you're going to do. And when I run into my kids, they're deacons in the church, they're pastors, they're mothers, they're school teachers. So, no. Is the group still together? No. But, and somebody, when one of the girls who ended up working at Lockheed, when she died, immediately I got one call from her husband's sister, and she called to let me know. And within 10 minutes, I had calls from three of the other kids saying, Ms. Taylor, I'm just letting you know that Laura passed. And I'll call you back when I know the arrangements and stuff. And then the next one call and say, okay, she passed, and they're going to do it. But immediately, because this is our group. This was our family. I took those 60 kids, which is when I think I knew my husband was all right, because I took those 60 kids in various cars to Six Flags. You take 60 teenagers. Youngest one was 13, the oldest one was 19, and that was the deal. Once you turned 19, after that, you had to become an advisor too, because what I was trying to do was raise up a group that could be self-perpetuating. But We took them all. We went on a picnic. And all I said was, nobody should be pregnant in the next 10 months. No baby should be born this year. If the baby's not born next week, oh, Miss Day, I'm just saying. I'm bringing little girls today whose parents don't let them date. Don't make me wish that I had not done this. We had no problem. Kids all decided that I was crazier than anybody they knew. And like I told my daughter and I told her friend, you need to think at least one person is crazy enough to actually kill you. See, because once you get the idea in your head from school and the news and the TV that, oh, child abuse against the law, they ain't gonna hurt me because I go. You need to think in your life there's one person, and every child, black or white, needs to think there is one person that may physically hurt me for messing up, not abuse you, but for messing up and betraying that trust. That's one crazy person I know. And I'm sure there's at least one in your life. It might be a Sunday school teacher. It might be a former teacher. There's one person that you keep thinking, I really don't want to tell if I messed up. Everybody else you tell, you go, they're going to be mad, but they'll understand. But there's one that if you mess up, you don't want to tell because you're crazy. So.
And what about the Heritage Museum? What's your vision for that?
That every room in this building shows some aspect of black history in Cobb County. One room could be the room that deals with all of the schools, because see, there were private schools before Cobb County, before City of Marietta actually built a school. There were church schools for blacks. One room would be for the churches. We've got churches over 100 and something years old. We've got churches in Cobb County that started before the Civil War. We've got one church that started in 1854. So it started when there were only one or two white churches here. But one room devoted to churches, one room devoted to education, one room devoted to our military. The first guy to die in Vietnam was a black kid who went to, he actually ended up going to Marietta High, but he was black. It should be noted. Politics. All of the people that ran for city council before Hugh Grogan won, and before James Dodd, and before Anthony Coleman, and before James Dodd was on the Board of Education, or my mom on the Housing Authority, or Charles Ferguson on the Hospital Board. This is a part of that political and government that people don't know about. Then, of course, we want to do the entertainers and the artists. Mm-hmm. And then we want a room that has the sports people. So every, and of course, most important, a community room that talks about things like the Go Rain or Shine Club, the Penny Pinchers Club, the Sportsman 20, the Corporate 12. These were all, the Bummer City Elks, the Masons, the Eastern Star. These were all groups that were community social groups, every one of which had part of their charter was raising and maintaining the standards of our community and helping to raise our children. So there should be a room devoted to these people, because they didn't write books and they just lived their lives every day in such a way that their children could do better. So there should be a place that really glorifies us and preserves us. And I've already said that in the, what is the cafeteria, I want to come to Kennesaw State and have the artists exhibit. Let them exhibit here. I don't get to Kennesaw State most of the time now to see when the art students put on their projects. Let them be here so people can see them and purchase them if they want to. One room is a gift shop, which will highlight local artists of all kinds, but it will also highlight people who write about black history. In put it in time context, not necessarily fictional, but if you're a fiction writer, we're going to feature your thing. But 80% of what should be in there should be by and about blacks. So, and in fact, I want 80% of it to be by Cobb County black. I tell them, I'm going to bend the rules for the guy over in Douglas County that invented the super soaker.